Hey, welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It is May 18th, 2020. I'm Scott Pianowski, your host. And rather than celebrate Reggie Jackson's birthday with 60 Minutes on Mr. October, we're going to talk about a baseball movie today. Obviously, there's no baseball on the field. We're hoping to get back to that soon. And trust me, when baseball comes around to setting a schedule and all that, I promise you, we'll have you covered with all the stuff you need to know, who to draft, who to avoid. But right now, we're kind of in a holding pattern. We're looking for some different things to do. And so I'm going to break tradition. We're going to talk about the movie Moneyball today, which is a movie about the 2002 Oakland A's. And moreover, just the Oakland A's of the Billy Beane era. And we're going to talk about with Andy Behrens. I almost called you Andy Dalton, but Andy Behrens.
You know, I get it a lot. I get it a lot. People confuse us all the time. I bet he hears Andy Behrens all the time.
Right. Right. Well, you know, if you had your hair, if you were to color your hair a little bit reddish, I mean, you guys would probably be mistaken for each other. Yeah, Andy Behrens, who's fresh off watching the Last Dance and celebrating another victory lap of the Bulls. I'm behind a few episodes, so don't spoil it for me.
Yeah,
I don't know if this baseball thing takes off or if Jordan is suspended for gambling. I think a lot of things are in play here, so I don't know how it finishes up.
Yeah, I know that you weren't paying the least bit of attention to any of the major North American sports in 1998, so that's a blank spot for you.
Yeah, what a fun one that was. Can you think, there's been a little parlor game thrown around Twitter of who should be the next big documentary for sports. Do you have a good answer for that?
Oh, wow.
You know, I've been calling for the Ralph Sampson documentary for years. I don't know that you go 10 parts on it, but I think they could at least go 2 good hours on Sampson.
I think that is actually a really good call. And you and I have obviously talked about that era of college basketball a lot, which is just ripe for some stuff. This is a little bit local to me because I'm just super interested in like Chicago public league basketball history and Chicago sports history generally. But I could certainly watch a 10-part series on, this is going to seem stupid to like younger listeners, but DePaul basketball in the late 70s and early 80s is just fascinating to me because they are a power. They are an absolute national power. They are the number one team in the country for long stretches. Like, people obviously today don't think of DePaul basketball when they think of like the great national programs, but they were perhaps the greatest national program. They had a team with Mark Aguirre and Terry Cummings, two badass NBA players who had long, good all-star game like level careers, and they couldn't get out of the first round of the NCAA tournament. They had great players. They had Rod Strickland. They had like that. It's just an absolute powerhouse that could do nothing in the biggest moments, except they happened to show up. They happened to crash the one Final Four where nobody remembers any of the other participants because it was the Bird Magic Final Four. I just think that entire DePaul era is super interesting to me.
I'd forgotten that they made it to the 1979 Final Four. Aguirre goes number
and
one.
They,
in draft.
You know what? You know what? They gave Indiana State everything they wanted too. It's that thing was either like a 2-point game or down to the final seconds. They gave Indiana State absolutely everything they wanted. Just a really, really good team that didn't do anything. And they, the other, while I'm thinking of it, they were very much in on a Chicago player named Benji Wilson, who was shot and killed as a senior in high school, and surely would have been, you know, if not top player taken in the draft. You know, there's like this spot in NBA history where the number one overall picks just don't seem that good. It's like Purvis Ellison and Danny Manning or whatever, and that would have been the Ben Wilson slot, right? And he was a, you know, I remember doing some stories about him when I was writing locally in Chicago, and coaches, Joey Meyer, who used to be at DePaul, and other coaches would talk about him where like they didn't know if he was going to be Kevin Garnett or he was going to be Magic Johnson, but he was that size, handled the ball, was a scorer, was a passer, and was going to be one of the great players of all time. And he might have gone to DePaul, and that, how interesting would that have been?
Right. To be a little bit fair to Danny Manning, when he went first, people thought he was going to be a superstar. Ellison was one of those, I don't know who else we pick, so we'll pick Purvis Ellison. And Joe Smith was like that a little bit later, where it's like, well, there's no obvious pick to make here, so I guess we're taking Joe Smith. People thought Manning was going to be a star. And, of course, he had carried that Kansas team on his back. Could you name anybody else in that Kansas team? Because off the top of my head, I
don't know. Hell no, I can't.
And I'm a huge 80s college basketball fan. And man, was it a different game with no shot clock, no 3-point clock, no 3-point line until the end of the decade. But anyway, we'll save that for the Yahoo Fantasy Basketball Podcast. and I can talk about that stuff all day. Today, Moneyball is the subject. Andy, we both rewatched the movie recently. at least I rewatched. I'm not even sure if it was your first watching or not. But I guess the first thing with Moneyball, obviously based on a book written by Michael Lewis and about a team that's doesn't have a big payroll, so they need to be smart sabermetrically. I think one thing we have to reconcile when we watch Moneyball, if you're a baseball fan, and not just like you and I, we write about it, we do this for a living, but anybody who's just a passionate baseball fan is going to have more sophistication in their minds than the movie is aiming for. You know,
yeah.
They're going for just somebody who understands the cursory understanding of baseball and maybe the back of a baseball card, that type of thing. And so if you followed baseball, you know that the Oakland A's had three presumably number one pitchers, right? Mulder, Zito, and Hudson are all legitimately number ones, all drafted by the A's, all homegrown. And so, they're hardly mentioned. I think Zito is totally ignored in the movie. I think Hudson at one point, Billy Bean talks to him for a second in the clubhouse.
Bean walks past him in the clubhouse and tells him to, I believe, throw the slider more. And he never
throw the slider.
He never even slows down. It's like, Huddy, throw the slider more. That's it. He nods, and that's all you see of Tim Hudson, who I believe the previous season had been the runner up for the Cy Young.
And then in this particular season, I think Zito's the Cy Young Award winner.
Yep.
No mention of Zito. Miguel Tejada is the AL MVP. No mention of Tejada. Eric Chavez is the star on that team. Very little mention of Chavez. He's also in that Huddy scene. I think at this point they just wanted to recognize that maybe Oakland had some other players other than Scott Hatterberg.
Right.
So they throw them all in like a 15-second montage. It's not even a montage of Billy Bean going around the locker room and talking to people. You know, Mike Magnanti here, Eric Chavez there. You know, Chad Bradford gets a lot of play in this movie. So this is a long-winded way of asking you, how do we reconcile the fact that this movie, if you have any backstory, if you follow the A's in real time or historically, if you've looked at this team, you realize that this story is somewhat inauthentic.
Yeah, it feels like an admission. This is the first time that I'd seen the movie. So I saw it 3 days ago in preparation for this. I read the book almost immediately when it came out. And then I think I reread it not too long, at like maybe a year later or something like that. And I haven't touched the book since. But I'd never seen the movie, in part because I was like, well, how are they going to make a movie out of that? That's a little weird. Whatever. I don't see everything that comes out. I'm not, a film aficionado necessarily. So I just hadn't seen it. I think purely as a film, bringing no baseball to it, I think it was a really nice movie. If you just look at it as like, an origin story of Billy Bean and a character study of Billy Bean, and you're able to detach what you're seeing in the film from the fact that that is an actual living person in the world, and you don't worry about the inconsistencies and all that. Like, I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. I actually thought Brad Pitt in sort of a subtle performance, really good, totally worth watching. And it, very much not like the book in a lot of really important ways. But when you come to it knowing what the A's of the early 2000s were, it does mess with your head a little bit, and it does interfere with the watching of the film, because as you say, obviously Tejada, who is, is he mentioned? Is his name said in the, I'm not even sure his name is said in the movie. Miguel Tejada is the MVP of the league, and Barry Zito wins the Cy Young that season. And on top of that, the prior two Cy Young runner-ups in the AL had been Tim Hudson and Mark Mulder, also pitching for that team. The movie it kind of begins with this idea that, oh my God, we have to replace Jason Giambi and Johnny Damon and Isringhausen. How do you do that? Going to be really difficult to do. You don't have to know that much baseball to realize that both Tejada and, like, I feel like the two stories of the A's of that era are like dominant pitching and the best players use steroids, right? it's hard to get around that, right? Like, both Tejada and Giambi were implicated multiple times. Giambi, I believe, admitted to it. I'm pretty sure Tejada was one of the guys who lied to Congress about it, right? And was suspended later in his career, I think, for amphetamines. I mean, like, that was part of the story of the Oakland A's of that era too. They weren't like the specific year that we go over in the movie, that we spend most of the movie in the 2002 season, and they've just had to replace Giambi and these guys. They were league average in the American League in run scoring. Like, they scored 800 runs. They were eighth in the American League in run scoring. So they didn't win 100 games because of Scott Hatterberg and their ability to score runs. Like if you just came to this movie not knowing anything about Oakland or anything about baseball, you might reasonably conclude that Scott Hatteberg was the most important, played by Chris Pratt, by the way. How cool is it if you're actually Scott Hatteberg and Chris Pratt played you in a movie? That's awesome. You might reasonably conclude that Scott Hatteberg's insertion into the lineup was the singular reason that Oakland won 100 games. And it's just, wow, that's not how it went down.
Yeah, you know, I'm getting that you took probably the same vibe that I did. I recently listened to a wonderful podcast with Bill Simmons, and it's bothering me. I can't think of Mallory Rubin. Thank you. Sorry about that, Mallory. Anyway, Mallory Rubin, Bill Simmons, they did a podcast on Draft Day, the Kevin Costner movie. And you know, almost half the podcast is making fun of how absurd it is and how many things they get wrong and how many things just don't pass the plausibility test. And they spend the other half just saying how much they love Kevin Costner. And by the way, Andy and I recently did a Kevin Costner thing on Boxed In I want you to watch. But how much they love Costner and how much the movie is fun. And it's not quite the same tone as Moneyball. But to me, it's like I'm perfectly fine. Not only do I look past the flaws of this movie or the factual inaccuracies, but I actually choose to celebrate them and see, okay, yeah, we had the MVP and the Cy Young Award, but let's make this a Scott Hatteberg movie, right? You know, that's just, to me, that's not a feat. That's not a bug. That's a feature that the movie does things like that. And I also, if you're just a baseball fan, there's just little things you can pick out. There's a poster of Reggie Jackson in the background that you can see for like a second. Happy birthday, Reggie. There's a Billy Ball, a bumper sticker in somebody's office somewhere that, again, you see it for a second. On Art Howe's desk, he has a little figurine of Dennis Eckersley in mid-delivery. Where it looks like he's trying to start his lawnmower. It's an old Lee Monfield joke about Eckersley's delivery. It looks like a man trying to start a testy lawnmower. It's awesome. It's just, it looks, they're obviously in the stadium. It's what the clubhouse looks like. It's what a manager's office would probably look like, stuff like that. I know they took liberties. I know they had to make it a popcorn movie. I know that certain things in the movie are either incorrect or they've stretched the truth. But I choose to celebrate that. I think that's part of the charm of the movie is that If you know these things are there, you can just kind of shrug and enjoy it anyway.
Jonah Hill's character, who I believe is sort of an amalgamation, like a composite character of a variety.
Variety. Deep Podesta didn't want to be in the movie.
Okay, yeah. So didn't want himself named in the film, right? So they have to invent this sort of fictional hybrid, whole bunch of personalities in there. But it's a great character. Jonah plays it really well and in a super understated way, right? Like he's not sort of over the top Jonah Hill in any way. He has to, the two scenes involving him that I probably enjoyed the most are when he awkwardly has to tell Carlos Pena that he's been traded, and he has a super awkward conversation with David Justice on the team plane, where Justice, you know, takes off his headphones and is like, hey, I have to ask you a couple things. And he asks him a couple really like uncomfortable questions that he doesn't have good answers to. And just like the tension in that is so good. It's like a super understated Jonah that I really enjoyed. But there's within his character is obviously he's sort of the embodiment of what would become and like to Billy Bean's credit and the credit of the organization, they really did unearth a market inefficiency there, right? Like people weren't across baseball, were not prizing obviously on base percentage at the level that they needed to, slugging percentage at the level that they needed to. And it all kind of gets boiled down to like on base percentage is all that matters in the film, which is obviously not exactly how baseball works, but that's kind of what they boil it down to. I also really enjoyed especially that early scene in the film with all the scouts discussing players. Some of the scouts, by the way, were played by themselves, which I think was really cool. Others were not. I love the way that they were discussing players, because that if you ever see, you know, really old scouting reports on like Hall of Famers, you know, I can't remember all the wording of these, but at some point I saw like a Dave Winfield scouting report when he was coming out of college. Like if you read those things, like that really has the ring of truth to it. The old men sitting around a table, discussing ball players. One of them thinks he's making an actual good point by saying that the player's girlfriend isn't particularly attractive, which shows that he doesn't have a lot of confidence. Like, they think they're saying things that are actually insightful. Like, it's crazy. And I buy that. I fully buy, having read old scouting reports of great players, that is really the kind of thing that was said in baseball boardrooms.
I'm not sure we're that much removed from it. I mean, Colin Cowherd will say with a straight face that he believes in quarterback face. He believes you want the best looking quarterback possible. And if you want to have some fun with scouting reports, go to NFL.com and do a search. Try to find the scouting report on A.J. Brown coming into the draft last year, the Tennessee receiver, and look at the flaws, the quote-unquote flaws they list for Brown. It's like he lacks swagger against Alabama. Yeah. That's one of the things. He may be more quick than fast. I mean, what's more terrifying, Andy, when you think you have a great receiver, then you find, oh, well, he's more quick than fast. I just can't stand when things fall apart that way. I also like that this movie – For all the things they do get wrong or overlook or they tweak with the baseball, it does also get a lot of things right. For example, it's kind of cool that Royce Clayton actually plays the largely unmentioned Miguel Tejada.
Yeah.
That's Royce Clayton playing him. And whoever plays David Justice looks like a freaking ball player, and he's in the batting cage ripping line drives. And he's
like,
just
nice swing too, right? Like, legit. Yeah.
To for a second, I'm like, that's not Justice, right? It doesn't look like him, but man, he's got muscles and he's sure hacking the ball pretty well. I mean, I like the stroke. The guy who played Justice was great, and I like that the Justice isn't, he's not militant against what they're doing, but he's just kind of like, hey man, I've been around baseball. This is kind of strange, you know. I think that role of a player who, yeah, you signed me, I'm going to do what you asked me to do, I'm on board here, but what are we really doing?
I actually like him as the sort of singular example of the player, and we can, you know, we can list off a whole bunch of these, and the first one that comes to mind is, like, Joe Morgan didn't necessarily realize all the reasons why Joe Morgan, the player, was as great as he was.
Such an irony, right?
Yeah, and, because Joe Morgan lived on base and had tremendous on-base skills, but, you know, I think maybe in Joe's head, he was the MVP because he stole a lot of bases and hit some home runs, and
it's unbelievable that Joe Morgan's the best player of the 1970s, and no announcer misunderstood the best player of the 1970s more than Joe Morgan, the announcer.
right. So I think Justice is a really, like, is just the singular example of a player who is great, who may not understand all the dimensions of his greatness, but is willing to go along with obviously what Oakland tries to do and what they ultimately do that is really successful. The other thing that I remember taking away from the book originally that is highlighted in the film and that I think has some, you know, broader applicability to, like, just the way we strategize in fantasy and all that is the idea, like, when they have to replace Giambi and Damon simultaneously, and they obviously don't have the money to do that because their team payroll is like $38 or $39 million or something like that, and those are billion-dollar ball players. They start thinking of, well, what is, and this is better explained in the book. They start thinking of what are the most important traits of these players, and how can we replace that in the aggregate versus trying to find one-for-one replacements for each of these guys. And obviously they determine that the most important trait of each of those players is that they would get themselves on base at a great rate. And they're able to go out and put together this, you know, composite version of just sort of a, you know, OBP on a dime. They go find Scott Hatterberg and coach him up to play a passable first base. And they find guys who can at least embody the most important traits of those ball players. And I always think that's, you know, this always occurs to me in fantasy when I have a star player who gets injured, like, what is the one thing that he does that I can't replace? I'm not going to be able to replace everything that this guy does, but what is the one thing that is most essential to my fantasy team right now? And how do I find that?
Right. A lot of times we draft by that too, where if the replacement level is high for a certain position, you don't have to prioritize it in the draft if you think you can get it for free or for an inexpensive cost off the wire or in trade or whatever it is. That's why a lot of people in single quarterback leagues won't prioritize quarterback, because they can just take one late and who knows, maybe they can just pick up Derek Carr or pick up Joe Burrow or something and if they need to in the middle of a season. You know, I don't know if this was cut out of the movie or not, but when they talk about market inefficiencies, one thing that this team does very well, now the movie plays up the idea that Jason Isringhausen is a big loss, but one thing that the A's have known for a long time and Billy Beane's known for a long time is how easy it is to just mint a new closer, whether you trade for one, you elevate somebody on your team, and then you can treat that as an asset that's gained value, and then you flip it. And they did that this year. They got Billy Coach. Is it Coach or Cock? I forget. It's been so long I can't remember. I think it's Coach, right?
I don't remember if it's Coach or Koch.
Let's go with Coach.
I thought I always said Koch.
Yeah, Coach Koch. Well, anyway, they get him from Chicago, and he has a nice season. Again, you know, he shows up in the movie once or twice, but they never really talk about him. And then they flip him in trade, and they basically they acquired him cheaply, and then they flip him for more assets. So, you know, Isringhausen was really the easiest guy to replace. I mean, Giambi's a monster because he was kind of an MVP candidate type of player. But Dabin, good, not great, not that great on defense. Didn't have much of a throwing arm for sure. But
I think the idea of, in fact, I think they even talk about it as just selling the closer in Moneyball. I think that's the phrase that the book uses. And they do that year after year, right? And it's one of the things that they did extremely well. And one of the things that obviously, if you're a small payroll team, there's no way you can ever spend money on the closer position. That would just be silly. You'd never have a $5 million closer. And they did it really well for several years. They would baseball is probably past this to a certain extent, but the idea back then, we're talking like, it's crazy that it's already 20 years ago, but like 20 years ago, there was a magic to the guy who could get 35 to 45 saves. Mm-hmm. There was that, like, people imagined a special quality in the ninth inning that wouldn't exist in other innings. And if you could get those, if you could rack up that simple stat, you had extraordinary value across the league, and the A's exploited that certainly better than any other team.
Well, they invented two waves of closers because they invented the one inning closer kind, or they popularized it with Eckersley and with the idea this guy in the seventh, this guy in the eighth, and Eckersley used to always talk about La Russa and say, "Look, he never warms me up unless I'm going to pitch," because a lot of relief pitchers would tell you, I'm rereading the Bronx Zoo right now with Sparky Lyle in 1978, and Martin is so spastic with the bullpen, get up, no, just throw, don't, I don't need you, yes, I need you, no, sit down, no, you're not pitching. La Russa was like, Eck, warm up, you're coming in, you got the ninth tonight, period, end of story. And so none of this, warm up and don't go in the game, none of this come into somebody else's jam, all that stuff. And you can argue whether or not that's been good or bad for baseball. It's just kind of a fact that it's one thing I struggle with is as baseball becomes more efficient and as baseball becomes, as the teams are smarter, you think about like the shift and everything. Is it smarter to shift when you have data? Absolutely. Is it better for the game? I'm not necessarily sure that's true. Is it better for the NBA that now they've learned how to use the three-point shot effectively and efficiently? Does that make for a better game? I mean, how do you feel about just like shifting and the idea that a team playing at maximum efficiency that may not be for the best product on the field?
Well, I feel like you and I are probably very in sync on this. I think all sports are more entertaining when there is a diversity of style across the league. I think it's a pretty major concern with people love the NBA when stars are in the finals and all that, and when there's super teams and whatnot. But I think it is a stylistic problem that the NBA has right now. That is, by the way, not it's a bad idea if you don't have the Warriors personnel to try to be the Warriors, right? It's a bad idea if you don't have a player of James Harden's ability to try to force someone into that role, and to, like, all you can do is be a lesser version of a great team. Like, you're 100% not beating the peak Warriors, like the KD, Steph, Clay Warriors, by doing a lesser version of what they did, right? Like, there's no hope there. If they have the best players for it, like, whatever, you can play a more efficient game, but you can't win. And it was fun in the one of the things that made the 80s fun. It's not like some old man nostalgia. The 80s were fun because you had major stylistic differences between great teams. You had the Rockets trying a Twin Towers approach that, nobody who had ever paired a 7'4" dude with like a 7-foot dude, and let's see how that works. And you've got the Lakers playing with pace, and all they want to do is play in transition, and you've got the Celtics playing a different style, and like, that was fun. That's generally fun in sports. And the 70s and 80s in baseball were certainly no different. You had the Orioles played a very different style from like Whitey Herzog teams, and you just and Billy Martin teams, and you just had different managerial styles, gave you very different looks and very different approaches. And yeah, like the game is always more interesting when it matters, like who's in town. Oh, I'm going to see a different brand of baseball this week than I saw last week, because it's not Earl Weaver anymore. It's whoever.
You said that very well. And I totally agree that when we see, I saw somebody recently say on Twitter, I don't know who it was talking about there should be uniformity with baseball parks. And I'm like, what are you, crazy? We should have 30 unique parks. Every park, and I don't care what your gimmick is. I mean, as long as, you know, you shouldn't have left field fence can't be 200 feet or something. But I mean, yeah, every park should have its own unique works. I'm totally for that. I want different styles. It just feels like everybody right now is just swinging for the fences.
Oh, give me a ball club that's built for a home park. Like, how fun is that? Mm-hmm. And that's the way it used to be. Like, we're going to play in the old polo grounds. I got to have a center fielder who can really roam it. You know, like, that's fun.
Yeah, well, getting back to Moneyball for a second, I think this one of the things that the film does to manipulate us is it needs to give us a sense of urgency. He needs to give us a stick, because the A's don't play in the big game, right? They do make the playoffs, but they lose. So they treat the winning streak as basically their version of the big game.
Yeah.
You know, Billy Beane's all paranoid that they're going to somehow blow, win 20 in a row. Yeah, you know, they've already set the record, I think, and they're trying to win 20 in a row. And they want you to have a stake in that. They want you to have a stake that his daughter somehow will have an unhappy life if Billy Beane gets fired, or that Billy Beane's head is on the chopping block, that if this doesn't work,
yeah,
he's going to be laughed out of baseball when by the end of the movie he's offered a gigantic contract by the Red Sox. So you need to think that there are stakes involved here. And they also, this is one of my favorite scenes of the movie, is when they go to recruit Scott Hatterberg. And, you know, first of all, they show up at his house. You know, they call him on the phone. Hey, Scott, we're outside. Let us in. You know, like, that's really how, you know, that's how free agents are recruited, right? You know, that's how the Bull signed Rodman. They just went to his house and knocked on the door. But so they bring in Juan Washington and Billy Beane. And I love how they have, this is manipulative, but for some reason I enjoy this. I don't know why. Hatterberg's wife is at the dinner table with a bunch of, obviously, bills, like, you know, bills that are probably due or past due that they don't know how to pay them. And here come the Oakland A's, you know, gonna save the day with a contract. And then Billy Beane goes, oh, you'll learn how to play first base. Washington, tell him it's not that hard. And Washington immediately just deadpans, it's incredibly hard. And, you know, I there's just something about that scene. You have to buy into the idea that the Hatterbergs are in financial trouble. Hatterberg's career is just about over, and somehow the A's and Hatterberg are going to realize that they're actually a perfect fit for each other.
That is such a good, obviously you're talking about a couple of really good actors there, and I don't know at what point this film is made in the career of Chris Pratt, but like, he's great. Everybody plays kind of an understated version of the sort of characters that we see in later films from them. But like, that's such a good scene in Hatterberg's home. But it is part of the reframing of the Oakland A's as a team that was somehow powered by Scott Hatterberg, which again is certainly not the lesson that anyone should take away from the film. But if all you know about the Oakland A's is what you learn in the film version of Moneyball, that is for sure what you're going to take away. But yeah, you're right. He's like grabbing at his forearm as they're having the meeting, and they're trying to ask him how the arm is, and he wants to lie, but he can't lie, right? Like, 'cause he just can't throw anymore. He's a catcher who has to shift positions. It is a great moment in his career for the film to capture, for sure. You know what I really like? A scene that I really liked was actually, you alluded to it, was late in the film, the John Henry Billy Beane scene, just in Fenway. When Henry, obviously a smart guy, a zillionaire, fully recognizes, and the Red Sox have already hired Bill James, and they're on it. Like, they know that there's a ton of inefficiency around baseball, and they have a good sense for the fact that they're about to seize on that. And not only do they know more than other teams, but they have a ton of money, right? So like, they're going to be able to fully realize Beane's vision and sort of implement all the best ideas of the Oakland A's. And so John Henry comes across great in the film because he's ahead of his time a little bit. He's making the right offer to the right guy at the right moment. It's just a really nice scene, and it's a way of verbalizing for anybody who didn't already understand what was going on in the film exactly what's about to happen in baseball.
I love that scene takes place in Fenway Park too. In fact, my dog, as I'm rewatching the movie, my dog named Fenway. You can probably put those two pieces together. He perked up when the Fenway Park scene came about, and I don't think that's a coincidence. And I love how John Henry says, you know, with all respect to the Coliseum, you know, this is a ballpark. You know, and Bean just goes, yes, it is. You know, and they're sitting there having their tea and talking about it. And you know, for all the things, again, historically, that the movie tweaks or is a little bit unfair about. And I even, as I remember the book, I remember the book kind of downplaying the pitching too, that not being super yes. heavy on those three aces. And I thought that was a criticism of the book. It's a heavier criticism of the film. It just ignores those three guys. One thing that I think the film gets right historically is that Bill James was ahead of his time and was a pioneer. And they actually show brief little snippets where you can see the old books that he would write. And you get a sense of just, you know, Bill James must have gone to Kinko's and printed these things out, you know, printed out 100 yeah, of them or 200 yeah. of them. You know, just how far aged the printing process is. But Bill James, now, I don't think the stakes are what Billy Beane makes them out to be in the movie. He's not going to be unhirable if somehow the A's don't have a good season in 2002. People realize he's smart. But when Bill James got involved, people went from one, not knowing who he was, to two, being intrigued, but like still thinking he's a wacko, to three, like, we got to stop this James character. He's bad for baseball. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Bill James did actually face that much oppression, and he had to until he became kind of accepted. I mean, as Henry says, I can't believe it took so long for him to be hired by a baseball team. What's up with that? And Bean goes, yeah, well, baseball hates him.
Yeah, I as you were describing all that, I was thinking of it's one of my, I think I saw it in an interview, and it's one of the most insightful things that I had ever read from Bill James, who obviously a lifetime of great baseball insights. I remember him in an interview talking about how certain player traits, and his example for this was speed. Certain player traits are just massively, almost unimaginably, inexpressibly important at lower levels of a sport and have almost no meaning when you get to the highest level of the sport. And I thought that, like, man, speed, just a perfect example of that. Because if you can just put a ball in play in Little League and you're the fastest kid in town, you're on base. Nobody can throw anybody out. Right. Like, there's no such thing as a caught stealing among 10-year-olds. Right. Like, there's, you know, speed is such a massive factor at lower levels. And as you obviously as players get better, as the level gets better, as players are have an easier time making the routine play, it's less and less important by the time you get to the major leagues, when, you know, one of the great insights of Bean and people like him is that, you know, unless you're stealing bases at like an 80 or 85% rate, you probably shouldn't be running anyway. You're running yourself out of innings. You're running yourself out of runs. Speed has very little importance and very little correlation to winning. And I don't know, like, as you were talking, I was just thinking of my favorite things that I've ever heard Bill James say. And that is probably the most insightful.
Probably my favorite. That's, man, that's excellent, excellent stuff right there. And you're totally right. I remember when I was a catcher and maybe Little League, age 11, age 12. And we had a third baseman who really wasn't solid about catching the ball. So my coach told me, if somebody steals third, do not throw the ball to third. And I'm like, but coach, one, the fans are going to be all over me. And two, the other team's going to realize this in 2 seconds, that they can have third base whenever they want it. He's like, I don't care. Because he realized the price of throwing the ball to third was, you know, the guy not catching it, and then now they've come home. So it was better for us to concede third base. You know, as you said, it wasn't like I was throwing people out at second either. I remember one year in senior league, we did a pitch out, and we successfully got the pitch out. Like, the person was going, and I barely threw the person out anyway. I was lucky. I would have thought how embarrassing it would have been if had I not thrown somebody out on a pitch out. But it's hard, man. It was. I mean, I stole a bunch of bases. I've always been slow, but it was so hard to throw somebody out. You might as well run and dare somebody to do it. But my favorite James thing, and it ties into one of my favorite baseball players, as you know, is Dwight Evans. I also took him in the DJ Short Roto World Draft. James had often talked about the idea that people who are good at a lot of different things tend to be underrated, and people who are specialists, who are outstanding in one area, tend to be overrated. And I've always drafted my fantasy teams to try to get boring efficiency guys who I used to like, Rusty Greer types who would do a little bit of everything, but maybe weren't as exciting as somebody who had that one glittering skill or that one glittering stat. And I still think that's true. I still think that's an inefficiency both in fantasy and in real life.
Dwight Evans is such a great example of that. You and I have both, I'm sure, recently rewatched Game 6 of the 75 World Series, which is obviously one of the great games of all time, and it's been on MLB Network a ton. And man, that guy could cover some ground in right field. Like, he makes a couple of routine plays in that game that probably shouldn't have seemed routine, and then he makes one of the all-time catches very late in a very important game in right field that saves runs and saves the game and preserves the series for another day. What an awesome player.
I also think it's fascinating. There aren't that many guys like this, but when somebody's career in their 30s is totally different from their 20s, Evans comes to mind, Paul Molitor comes to mind. Somebody in this movie who's mentioned a couple times is Raul Ibanez, who had no career in his 20s and then became, you know, the founding member of the Raul Ibanez All-Stars. I used to love these boring veteran players. Look at what Nelson Cruz, right? He had the most home runs in the 2010s. He had no career to speak of until he hit about age 30. And all he's done is conk home runs since then. I always think it's fascinating when a player has an upside down career like that.
Jim Edmonds was a little bit the same way, right? He was a good player and then went to St. Louis and was one of the best center fielders of all time, right? Like, yeah, I'm with you. It's a super unusual career arc. But it's pretty amazing when it happens. And Evans just played so, like, he was so good for so long, and was probably like a top 25-ish player in the game forever for his entire career. Never had that, like, maybe got robbed of an MVP. And if he wins it, maybe we think of him differently and maybe the Hall of Fame comes calling. But just never had that singular season where he was obviously the best player in the league.
Yeah, it hurts him that his best season was a strike season, 1981.
Yeah.
So, again, like, Alan Trammell's in the Hall of Fame now. I always feel if Alan Trammell won the 1987 MVP, which he probably should have, he would have waltzed into the Hall of Fame. And if Evans, to be fair, I think Ricky Henderson was probably the best player in the American League that year, but Evans and Henderson were neck and neck. I don't know how Raleigh Fingers won the MVP that year. He was great, but he's a relief pitcher, and he didn't throw an insane amount of innings. I mean, when relievers win awards, but they threw like Mike Marshall 1974 innings or Bruce Sutter 1979 or 77 for that matter.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it. When a guy has more of a one, and Fingers would go deep in games. I get it, but they got that MVP wrong. I feel like Evans should be in the Hall of Fame. I feel like he's better than Rice and Lynn. Lynn won the 75 MVP justly. Rice is in the Hall of Fame. Evans will probably never get in, although he's been on a couple of those Veterans Committee ballots, so maybe he has a chance. We haven't talked at all about Philip Seymour Hoffman in this movie. He plays Art Howe. And we're in our draft, we're going to get to Philip Seymour Hoffman movies. We'll do that in a few minutes. And just a shout out to Art Howe, who's, I guess, back home after a hospital stay. He has COVID-19 coronavirus. And, you know, obviously we're all pulling for him and glad to see that things are improving. What do you think of Philip Seymour Hoffman as Art Howe?
Well, obviously, Philip Seymour Hoffman is always great. He's great in the film. That's one of the things I can't believe it took us this long to get to it. One of the things that I really felt bad about. This movie did Art Howe pretty dirty, right? Right. Like all we see of Art Howe is this sort of caricature where he is. And I'm sure the real Art Howe was resistant to many of the things that Bean was talking about. I'm sure that's true. But being a major league manager is a pretty huge job, right? And it involves a ton of things, and it is way more difficult than simply the sort of paint by numbers, version of the job that I feel like we kind of get in this movie, where it's like Billy Bean has to come in and tell him, okay, nobody's stealing bases anymore, and nobody's bunting anymore, and by God, Hatteberg plays first, not Carlos Pena. Which is, I don't know, looking back on it, Carlos Pena, pretty good ball player who had actually had on base skills in the minors. And I'm not sure why they had to vilify Carlos Pena so much here.
Pena became a star eventually. It wasn't right away.
Yeah.
It took a couple of trades for him.
Certainly Pena's best seasons were better than Hatteberg's best season, right? Pena, really good player. And not entirely wrong that Art Howe might have wanted to play young Carlos Pena over Scott Hatteberg, who couldn't defend his position. And they were probably comparable at the plate, whatever. I just feel like the film kind of did the actual legacy of Art Howe pretty dirty, because Art Howe obviously had to manage a pitching staff, and you know if you're a major league manager, you're making 1,001 decisions every day that are more complex than who's starting at first base. And the movie kind of boiled his job down to who's starting at first and are we bunting or not.
Right. I mean, you're, I always look at managing a sports team, say a baseball team. You have 25 guys, and not everybody plays, not everybody likes each other, and you're on tour for 7 or 8 months, and you need to keep everybody from tearing each other's eyeballs out. You know, I mean, you need to keep harmony and keep this traveling circus in a happy state of union. It's not an easy thing to do. Somebody's always going to be unhappy with their playing time. Somebody's always going to be unhappy with their batting slot or what they're asked to do. You know, my skills are better used this way. You're telling me, you know, I'm a base stealer. You're telling me not to steal bases, you know, all sorts.
And one of the things that the film actually tells us about Billy Bean is that he spent a ton of time away from the team, right? Like, he didn't like to be in the stand. He didn't like to watch games live. Right. Like, he'd go to the workout room or he'd be in the car and he'd periodically check in on the games, and he wanted the Jonah Hill character to, like, oh, tell me the play by play, whatever. Like, Billy Beane wasn't around the team. Art Howe is flying that plane, right? And for a while in that season, that plane is on fire and he has to land it. Not only does he land it, he lands it with like 100 wins or 103 wins or something like that. So Art Howe, somewhere along the line in that season, did a great managerial job, and we don't really get
right.
To see
and
that.
To be fair, I think the tension between Beane and Howe is realistic. And then Howe left the team after this season. I believe he was fired, although it may have just been a mutual thing. He got hired immediately by the Mets. I feel like anytime somebody is fired and immediately hired by somebody else, how bad could they have been? I mean, Art Howe landed on his feet.
Right.
He wasn't successful with the Mets, but he also had a managing stop in Texas. So, I mean, the guy was a bona fide baseball manager. Maybe he wasn't a great one, but he certainly wasn't a lousy one either. And, you know,
I was also, as a kid, I was a huge fan of the 1980 Houston Astros, and it was just bizarre that Art Howe was their first baseman, right? Like, you had a first baseman who hit, I don't know, he probably hit 9 or 10 home runs that season, probably hit 280, but got on base a little bit. Really, like, really fun player at a great
moment. It
makes
me sad that we never had, I don't think we had an Astrodome World Series, right? By the time Houston made the World Series, they had the new stadium, right?
Right.
This would have been cool. Right. Of course, they played in two of the great playoff series, the 1980 NLCS, and then which had one home run hit the entire series, and then the famous 1986 NLCS, where if the Mets don't win game six, which goes, what, 16 or 17 innings, then they have Mike Scott, yeah, who was untouchable that season. Although very touchable, I might say, in the Roto World Sim League, because I just beat Mike Scott. Take that, Rudy Gamble. He's got the, speaking of Moneyball, Rudy Gamble, you see his salary, his accrued salary in this league? It's like way ahead of everybody else's. So I guess he's got the Moneyball team going for him. I'm not surprised that Rudy is a step ahead of us in that sim. But hey, we're 1-0. We're going to try to build on it. Let's transition to our draft. Philip Seymour Hoffman is my favorite actor. And man, I'm still kind of beaten up by the fact that we've lost him. I believe he died on Super Bowl Sunday some 7-8 years ago. And we're going to draft Philip Seymour Hoffman movies. There's no criteria for this draft. You want to pick the movies based on the Hoffman role, that's fine. You want to go on the strongest movies that you see that he was in, whether or not he was a big part of them, that's fine too. There are no rules. When I asked you if you would do this draft, you said, I'll do it if I can pick first. So you must have something good. You must have something good lined up.
I feel like you and I are going to have enjoyed, because you're much more a student of film, I think, than I am. And I know you're a great fan of Philip Seymour Hoffman. So in all likelihood, you will be a bigger fan of movies in which he has a more prominent role. I happen to know that the one movie where you and I intersect and both love the character that he played and the way that he plays it and the film itself is Almost Famous. So that's my top pick is going to be Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Lester Bangs in Almost Famous. There are like the moments in that film where he has the conversations in the kid about the nature of being uncool. Like the kid calls him and he's like, oh, I'm so glad you're home. And he's like, of course I'm home. I'm uncool. Like the conversations they have about the nature of being uncool are incredible. And I'll just say that, like, I don't know, maybe it's a case where like I read Lester Bangs at the right time. Like if people haven't read, you know, whatever, if you're an avid reader, you like rock criticism, you like good writing. The compilation is called Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung. Lester Bangs was such a good writer, like just a dazzling writer. Way better than anybody else who was writing rock criticism in the 70s. Just a like an intimidating sort of great writer.
Intimidatingly great.
And a huge figure in, you know, sort of 70s pop culture and someone who, like, in my mind, became as much of a rock star as anybody he was covering at the time. Just an absolutely brilliant writer. And the character is so well played in that. He probably doesn't even have that much screen time in the movie, but it is by far the most memorable character from it.
Yeah, it's the right pick, I think. Only 4 scenes. So it's a support.
God, is that right?
I've rewatched them over and over again. I think they add up to maybe 10 minutes. They meet in a diner. The little kid goes, William Miller goes to the radio station where Lester Bangs is making an appearance. And then they sit down in like a little, you know, abandoned luncheonette. There's nobody else in the restaurant. And Lester Bangs is saying, hey, you should really just do something else with your life. Rock and roll's over. You know, you missed it. You know, you're just getting the last whiff of it. And he's like, oh, man, I can see from the look in your face you're not going to. And he's like, oh, you know, they're gonna give you drugs. You're going to meet girls. You're going to get free records. I know it sounds great, but, you know, you can't – don't make stars of these mediocre rock people. They're you know, don't do what they want you to do. Don't let them use you. So there's that scene. And then there's a scene where William Miller's freaking out because he can't get his interview, and he's going to be behind on the story. And this is, man, this is great. Any writer who knows what it's like to be, you know, behind on a deadline and freaking out over that. And he goes, oh, this is what you do. You tell them it's a think piece about a mid-level band, you know, all that stuff, and how to handle Ben Fong Torres. So that's one of the scenes. There's the scene where Bangs gives him the go-ahead to do the story. And you can opt for Rolling Stone. I'm telling this out of order a little bit. But you can tell Bangs is a little bit jealous because, you know, he only was for Cream Magazine. I mean, he never is going to write for Rolling Stone. And he's a little bit of a misunderstood genius. But then he finally says, yeah, right, whatever. Write the story. But don't let those swill merchants rewrite you. That's a great scene. And then, of course, the famous scene that you were talking about at the end where he said, you made friends with him, didn't you? He said, yeah, it was fun. He goes, and I met you. You know, they made you feel cool. He's like, I met you. You are not cool. And William Miller goes, I know. Even when I thought I was, I knew I wasn't. I could go on this. I'm just going to have to stop because this will never end. And, you know, Raghu, our producer, will end up strangling me with a recording tape. But great pick.
I'll just say the articles that Lester Bangs articles doesn't do him justice. The pieces that he wrote on Lou Reed for Cream, like throughout his career, are just because he loved all the Velvet's early stuff, loved Lou Reed, and then really resented the artist that he became at certain points in his career, and the antagonism between those two that shows up in his writing. It's just so good. If you've never read Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor, don't go find
I've read a fair amount of it. I've actually also listened to some audio tapes of interviews with Lester Bangs, and one reason I love Hoffman so much is he immersed himself in Lester Bangs to try to really nail the character. And Cameron Crowe to this day, I mean, he said this before Hoffman died, so it's not just, you know, flowery things said after somebody's death. He said, I can't believe how much Hoffman threw himself into the role and how much he embodied Lester Bangs and what he stood for and what his writing was about, and that presence and that power and that antagonism. A true critic. I mean, a critic just doesn't rubber stamp stuff and put smiley faces on things. Yeah. A true critic isn't afraid to tell you the truth, even if it's ugly at times, and Lester Bangs was all that. So I'm just going to try to make my pick quickly because, you know, we could talk about Almost Famous for easily for an hour or two. But I'm going to pick Boogie Nights. It's also a supporting role. It's not a headliner. But, man, just the vulnerability for that character, just to admit he really doesn't like himself. And, you know, he buys a car because he's in love with Dirk Diggler. But then he admits he'll take the car back if Dirk doesn't like it. I'm just blown away at how much emotional awareness there is in that character, Scotty J in Boogie Nights.
What a cast. Like, obviously that was on my short list of films to draft in this thing. That cast is absolutely incredible. I don't think I've seen the movie since we saw it in a theater. I need to watch that again.
It's a masterpiece. It's one of those movies you have to have justifiable reasons to make a movie as long as that movie is, but I think far and away, although Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't make bad films, I think that's unquestionably his masterpiece. Let's get to round two. What's your next pick in the Philip Seymour Hoffman draft?
I can probably wait on this because I don't think of it as even a particularly good film. I just want to talk about the basketball scene in Along Came Polly.
Oh, God, I was going to take it.
The whole film is stolen absolutely by Ben Stiller and Philip Seymour Hoffman, like, shooting hoops, right? And every time Philip Seymour Hoffman throws a shot up, he says something like, rain dance or let it rain or something involving rain, or he'll drive to the bucket and yell white chocolate. And like, it's not just that everything misses, it's that everything misses like 3 feet away from the rim itself and smacks off the backboard with like a loud thunk, and it's just priceless. And he's like, they even get themselves into like a 2-on-2 pickup game, and the smack talk that Hoffman's character tries to throw at the other two guys. What does he call him? He calls the one guy like white Sasquatch or something like that. It's just phenomenal. Like, you don't think of maybe physical comedy when you think of Philip Seymour Hoffman, but it's one of the most, I don't know, maybe it's not underrated, but it's one of the most amazing sports scenes in film in the last 30 years.
I'm generally not a physical comedy guy, but I think it's outstanding. And I think Hoffman comes really close to stealing that movie too. And you remember, he plays the person who was famous for 15 seconds early in his life and hasn't gotten over it. He was in this movie, Crocodile Tears, which is a takeoff on The Breakfast Club. And he thinks, you know, he's secretly filming his own documentary, hoping that he can get a documentary company to buy it. And he thinks he's something special. And he looks down on people, even though his life has gone nowhere. And he steals that movie. I'm not really the biggest fan of the rest of the movie, but Hoffman totally crushes it.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great pick. And I was going to pick, I don't know when I was going to pick it, but it was a movie I was certainly going to pick. I guess I'm just going to try to make the draft make sense and take Capote, because it was the film where Hoffman finally won the Academy Award. It's his chance to be, because a lot of his work is character actor work, is supporting actor work. And here he is just taking on a monumental role. And I feel like the Academy Award was justified, but it was also kind of a lifetime achievement award for all the times he could have won and didn't. Truman Capote. I feel like it has to go off the board at some point. So let's get that here in the round two.
Yeah, no, I would have taken it. He, like, what a difficult voice to nail. Because I mean, nobody just like out in life that you'll run into day to day sounds like that. And he really mastered it. Like a character with a bunch of quirks and mannerisms that he just absolutely nailed. So that's obviously a good call and a wonderful role. I'm gonna take another, like, I mean, it's a supporting role, but I loved the way he played it, and it's just such a fun film that I don't need to really tell people about, is The Big Lebowski. His role is Brandt in The Big Lebowski. Super fun. He's mostly a straight man in this movie, right? Like he's not the guy that gets necessarily the like he's setting other people up in this film. He's setting the dude up. But he's so good. It's such a, like, I feel like I'm picking Hoffman characters that are just all over the map, which kind of speaks to the breadth of his talent, I guess.
Yeah, it's a great pick in a very beloved movie by the Coen brothers. I can take a movie where he's a very small role in, but I want people to watch this movie. And I think actually it's a great Hoffman role anyway. Paul Thomas Anderson, again, Punch Drunk Love, which is Adam Sandler in a straight role. There's a little comedy in it, but it's not much. In fact, the funny thing is Hoffman's the guy who's probably the funniest in the movie. He plays a person who owns a mattress store who's also running a bunch of kind of like Shylock type businesses on the side. And there's a point of dispute of whether or not Sandler owes him money. And Hoffman tries to strong arm him. And at this point, because Sandler has found love, nothing's going to stop him. It's a quirky movie. And I think a lot of people probably haven't seen it, but I think it's a different side of Sandler. For all the people who have thought of watching Uncut Gems, which I thought was very difficult to watch and very tense and stressful, I would say watch Punch Drunk Love instead. You can see Sandler in a different light, and you also just get the Mattress Man, a really funny, if brief, moment of Philip Seymour Hoffman brilliance.
This is not my official pick, but I had totally forgotten that I'm on Hoffman's IMDb page now, and I had completely forgotten that he's in Twister. what a crazy fun career.
Save that for
again,
the Helen Hunt draft, pick. Andy. But anyway, we're a little bit low on time. Let's go speed round for the next two picks.
Okay, I'm gonna pick Pirate Radio, which is just a I don't know. I remember thinking at the time, I've only seen it once again, but I thought it was a really fun story. It's about like he's the Count. Is that who he plays? I think he plays a character called the Count, and they're on a ship. It's like the 60s Britain. They don't want any rock music played in the country, so they basically operate a rock music station from the sea, from like the North Sea or something.
I actually have not seen that movie, so. I made it a goal to see every Hoffman movie that he made, so I'll have to add that to the list. I'm going to pick in the fourth round Owning Mahoney, which is, it looks like Mahoney, but it's actually Mahoney. I'm just going to say it's Philip Seymour Hoffman in a leading role playing a degenerate gambler who embezzles from his bank, from his company, to contribute to that gambling. So, you know, degenerate gambling, Philip Seymour Hoffman, you had me at hello.
Man, I am being reminded as I look at his IMDb page.
Well, you really studied for this draft. You're like drafting out of a magazine right now.
this is very much what's going on here. I'd forgotten that he was in Charlie Wilson's War too, which is
Charlie
really
Wilson's
good.
I think War.
I think I'm actually going to pick that one, because that was really, really enjoyed that. Enjoyed a lot of the performances in it too, like really fun. I need to see that again. I'm being reminded now of all the movies I need to rewatch.
Man, a lot of things still here. The Savages, Happiness. Oh, man, don't watch Happiness. Talented Mr. Ripley. I'm going to take The Master. So there's a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson in this draft, but just a takedown of the L. Ron Hubbard cult. And again, the opportunity for Hoffman to be the head of a movie, which I think he pulls off perfectly fine. Let's give him another leading role in The Master. That's our 5-round Philip Seymour Hoffman draft. Feel free to tell us what we missed out on Twitter. Andy Barron's on Twitter, Scott_Pianowski. It's a solid hour for the show. Let's wrap this up. Thanks to the Oakland A's for being in our life for an hour. Thanks to Billy Bean. Red Sox did win the World Series. I love how they gave Bean credit for that in the credits. That was kind of funny. Anyway, for Andy Barron's, for Raghu, our fearless producer who puts up with me and makes us sound great on the podcast, on the air, I'm Scott Pianowski. Next week, we'll have another guest. We'll talk loosely about baseball. And until then, go see some Philip Seymour Hoffman movies. We'll talk to you soon.
I'm Michael Isikoff, Chief Investigative Correspondent for Yahoo News.
And I'm Dan Clydman, Editor-in-Chief of Yahoo News.
We're the hosts of Skullduggery, a podcast that not only breaks down the news, but also breaks news.
We deliver authoritative analysis while drawing intriguing historical parallels from our decades of covering D.C. scandals.
With our current focus on the president and his administration's handling of the coronavirus, to the 2020 elections, we interview those helping to shape the stories.
So subscribe to and download Skullduggery wherever you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media at Skullduggery Pod.